Tim, alcoholic. Appreciate the kind words there. We, as Rob did say, we are on page 359, and the title of our story tonight is Tightrope. And this is story number 10 in part two, fourth edition. And let's get going. Trying to navigate separate worlds was a lonely charade that ended when this gay alcoholic finally landed in AA. So obviously we see why this story was chosen. This is actually written for the fourth edition. This is a groundbreaking story. This is groundbreaking because it's the first and only openly gay author. Now, we do know, for example, Marty Mann, A Women Suffer Too, author of that story in the big book, was gay, but that was a friends and family sort of information thing. That was not an openly gay thing. We did see a couple weeks ago, we saw in the story, Because I'm an Alcoholic, we saw that author mention in her story towards the end that later in life she decided she was a lesbian. But that's not the same thing as this. This is all out there. And it took until the fourth edition for us, you know, for this to happen. You would have thought, I mean, I would have thought that, you know, third edition in 76, we would have been through some of this. But to that point, but in researching some of this, I see that there was a whole journey here that got to this point. Another thing to note is that this title of this story is actually used to name some groups now and conferences and roundups that would be geared towards our gay membership. So that being said, let's get going. And the other thing I'll say is basically there was no information about this author, but he does give some data in the story, which I was able to use. And I think I did a pretty good job with getting to approximate years as we go along. I can get us sort of close to where he's talking. So let's go. Drinking was always a part of my family background. All the men in my family drank. My father and later my brothers were heavy drinkers. As long as a person held down a job, didn't embarrass his family or friends too frequently, and kept out of trouble, he was entitled to get drunk on a regular basis. Drinking was an adult thing to do, a part of growing up. I don't believe it ever crossed my mind that I shouldn't drink. I was raised in a conservative religion, and I commuted to religious schools some distance from my home. Because I had a quick mind and was comfortable with academics, I became something of a teacher's pet. As a result, I was a serious, shy, somewhat bookish child and teenager who found it difficult to relate to my peers. So when I went away to college, I was an alcoholic waiting to happen. My relation to alcohol was a love affair from the very beginning. Although I wasn't too thrilled with the taste, I loved the effects. Alcohol helped me to hide my fears. The ability to converse was an almost miraculous gift to a shy and lonely individual. So I'm privy to having read the whole story, but I'm going to fill in the years as we go along, and you'll see how I come up with the extrapolation. But he's talking here that he's going away to college, 1963, approximately 1963. It was at a time that I also began to struggle with the question of my sexuality. For me, the idea of becoming homosexual, the word gay wasn't then in common use, was unthinkable. Drinking helped me to forget and evade. Also, it provided some cover. When you are drunk, people are not surprised at an inability or disinclination to make any serious moves toward a woman. This struggle continued throughout the years of unsuccessful dating and pretending. So, he's making mention here that the word gay wasn't used as commonly as we would hear it now. And I did some research, and that didn't become that common until the late 60s, early 70s. So again, we're in 63. That's why he's making that statement. The word's not used that commonly for several more years. Oh, how about a little trivia thing? And I'm going to give you the answer right away because I know some of you young guys are going to Google this real fast, and that's not fair. But when is the first time that the New York Times used the word gay, meaning sexuality? What year New York Times used the word gay referring to sexuality? Go. 1987. I would have thought it was much earlier than that. That was an eye opener for me. Okay, let's keep going. When I eventually decided to act on my desires, the guilt and the shame, as well as the drinking, increased. Now I had to hide not only my thoughts, but also my conduct. I always tried to project the image of the conservative, masculine, deep-voiced loner with the mysterious, possibly tragic, but always heterosexual love affair in the past. I wound up living two separate and distinct lives, that of a gay man with friends and interests to match, and that of the straight man with a totally separate set of friends and interests. I had to walk this tightrope while trying to build a solid professional life as well. After college, I had gone on to law school, where drinking on a daily basis became the norm. I justified myself with the thought that a few drinks helped me to relax and focus on my studies. Somehow, I managed to do well in law school and to land several prestigious legal positions afterward. I soon learned that I could not drink during the day. If I had even one drink at lunch, the rest of the afternoon would be lost. Instead, I postponed my drinking until immediately after work and would then make up for lost time. So he graduates from law school here. He started in his career. We're in 1970. Work in a law firm added a third side to my already divided life. Now I had to try to maintain social relations with clients, members, and associates of the firm, in addition to my gay and straight friends from my private lives. Needless to say, as the drinking increased, things became ever more confused. Eventually, the pressures became too great. I had formed a serious relationship and decided that I could no longer carry on the deception. Instead, I would change careers and go into teaching. For a while, things seemed to be going well, but the slide toward active alcoholism was slowly accelerating. I had had my first blackout several years before. At that time, I told myself that if it ever happened again, I would stop drinking. It happened again and again and again, but I didn't stop. I was always able to come up with some explanation, excuse, or rationalization that justified my continued drinking. In time, personality changes began to occur with regularity when I drank. I had always had a sharp tongue when drinking. I frequently became vitriolic. At other times, I could be charming and affectionate, sometimes too much so. People never knew just what I would do or say. So now remember, he's left law and he's in teaching. He says that it improved things for a little bit, but then the slot progression came in. So now he's a teacher now. After a few years, I was a nightly blackout drinker. My lover drank heavily as well, and I began to compare my drinking with his. I argued to myself that I could not have a problem because his drinking was worse than mine at times. In fact, I suggested that he might try AA. When he did try this fellowship, I did all I could to undermine his efforts to get sober. His recovery would present an obvious, if unacknowledged, threat to my drinking. Eventually, the stress became too much and we broke up, but not before I had succeeded in undermining his recovery. So now we're in the mid to late 70s. The slide continued. Most of my friends were unwilling to put up with my conduct, the verbal and sometimes physical abuse, the midnight phone calls, the forgotten invitations, and the selfish disregard of anything but my own need to drink. Those few friends who did not withdraw were forced away by my resentments and increasing paranoia. I cut people out of my life, refusing to return phone calls and ignoring them when we met by chance. By the end of my drinking, only two people were willing to have anything to do with me on a social basis, and both were heavy drinkers who were not surprised by my actions. The cases in which disaster struck when I drank outside my home increased. I made inappropriate passes at parties or at people at work, both men and women. At other times, I awakened battered or with my watch or wallet missing or in the company of strangers whose names I did not remember and did not want to know. There were the inevitable injuries and accidents. I was ejected from bars because I would steal tips or change from bartenders or other customers to pay for the drinks I could no longer afford. At other times, I would get into arguments and be forced to leave. In consequence, I made the seemingly logical decision not to drink outside the house. Instead, most of my drinking was now solitary. When I left work, I would have a few stiff drinks at dinner and then go home. I would stop off at the kitchen to pick up my glass, some ice, and some mixer. I would go to my bedroom where I kept half-gallon bottles of gin and vodka and read while the ice melted, the mixer ran out, and sometimes the glass broke. Every night was blackout drinking. The really bad times were when I would have to struggle outside to a liquor store or bar late at night, weaving and not trying to stagger because I had miscalculated and run out of alcohol. I found it increasingly difficult to do anything more than work and drink. I was afraid to use public transportation or even to walk on the streets. My stomach was constantly upset, and my doctor had diagnosed a number of intestinal disorders. Even though I rarely drank away from home, my body was covered with bruises because I often fell down during blackouts. I never wore short-sleeve shirts, even in summer, because people would ask me about the bruises. One morning, I woke up with a numb leg and found that I had somehow ruptured two spinal discs while in a blackout at home. Okay, so we're at the bottom now. This is, he's racing to the end here. So I'll just read this first sentence. For the last 4 years, I lived alone in a small house. So this is 1984, from 84 to 88. His year of coming into the program, his date of sobriety is 1988, approximately. So this is approximately 1984. For the last 4 years, I lived alone in a small house. The ceiling of one room had collapsed, and plaster dust was everywhere, coating the garbage and newspapers that littered the floor. Empty food cartons, beer cans, bottles, and dirty clothes lay where they were tossed. I had gotten a cat because the mice were out of control, but I was not conscientious about cleaning up after the cat. It is not surprising that I had few visitors and neighbors tended to avoid me. The last few months were filled with fear and self-pity. I began to contemplate suicide with increasing regularity, yet I was afraid of dying. I remember thinking that this life would go on and on, never getting better and slowly fading away to nothing. Then I began to hear the whispers. I became convinced that there were people living in my house. I couldn't see them except for occasional glimpses out of the corner of my eyes. And so I concluded that they were small and somehow living in the walls or under the stairs. I could hear them plotting to kill me. There were nights when I went to bed with a knife in hand to protect myself. Other nights I locked myself in the bathroom so they couldn't get me. One night, I left a shot of vodka on the mantelpiece so they would go after that and leave me alone. Then a miracle occurred. An evening came when I decided to have one drink outside and then go straight home. I had that drink and left for my house. The next thing I remember is waking up the next morning with a stranger I'd picked up in a bar. Apparently, I had gone on autopilot and, in a blackout resulting from just one drink, had gone on a tear. The look of disgust and pity on the face of that stranger was the jolt I needed. I suddenly realized that my life was totally insane, that my drinking was out of control, and that I was either an alcoholic or a candidate for committal to the local asylum. Not wanting to be locked up, I decided to try Alcoholics Anonymous. I called my former lover, and he put me in contact with an individual who took me to my first meeting. Although I can barely recall anything about that meeting, I heard two things I have never forgotten. The first was, you don't have to drink again. This was a total revelation to me. For a long time, I had believed that alcohol was one of the few positive things left in my life. I looked forward to my first drink every evening and thought that alcohol was holding my life together. I had to drink to survive, let alone to have any comfort. Yet here, people who had been in the same boat were telling me that I didn't have to drink. I don't think I believed them that night, but it gave me enough hope to avoid drinking the rest of the day. The second thing I heard was, you don't have to be alone anymore. This too was a revelation. For years, I had rejected or been rejected by friends, lovers, family, and God. I was alone and afraid. My life had narrowed to work and the bottle, and work remained in the picture only because it was necessary to enable me to buy the bottle. The isolation and loneliness that alcoholism brought weighed heavily on me, and those words lifted an immense burden of fear. Again, I'm not sure that I completely believed, but I felt hope for the first time in years. So again, now this is his first soiree into the program, and we're in 1988. I did not fall in love with AA at first glance. The man who took me to my first meeting later became my first sponsor. And he had to put up with objections, arguments, questions, and doubts. Everything a trained but very muddled legal mind could throw at him. He was gentle with me. He did not push his opinions on me. He had the sense to see that I was so afraid and so used to being alone that I could not face a hard sell approach. He listened to my questions, answered some, and suggested that I could best answer others myself. He refused to argue, but was willing to explain and share his own experiences. I had asked him to be my sponsor before I knew what he did for a living, and felt I could not back out of the relationship when I discovered he was a minister. It not lost on me that the cosmos has a sense of humor. My alcoholism and my lifestyle had led me to reject the religion and the God of my upbringing. I had never replaced them. Instead, I was an agnostic, doubting the existence of God, but afraid to say so in case I was wrong. My self-pity and sense of victimization led me to doubt that a caring God could exist. If he did, why had he given me so many problems? I was very wary of the members who talked of their spiritual lives. My sponsor was a living damper on my intolerance. But even more, he told me that it would be all right for me to doubt God, that AA was not a religious program, and to belong, I did not have to adhere to any set of beliefs. He suggested that for me, a good starting point would simply be recognition of the fact that I had failed in running the world. In short, acceptance of the fact that I was not God. He also suggested that I might try occasionally to act as if I believed. Somewhere I had heard that it is easier to act yourself into a new way of thinking than to think yourself into a new way of acting. And this made sense in the context of acting as if. I also thought that the people in meetings sometimes seemed too standoffish and overly concerned with their friends and acquaintances rather than with me, the newcomer. Well, on my way toward developing a resentment, I expressed this to my sponsor. He suggested I might find people more communicative if I took the coffee making commitment for the group I had joined. Although I thought I was far too special to make coffee, I did figure that as coffee maker, I would have the chance to select decent cookies, and so I agreed. My sponsor was right. People did start to speak with me, if only to complain about the coffee and cookies. But once a conversation starts, communication frequently continues. I started to work on the steps, and even with my difficulty over the third step and the God concept, I began to develop the sense of trust in the AA group and in the ideals of the fellowship as a manifestation of a power greater than myself. Although for many years I did not come to an acceptance of a God who intervened personally and directly in the lives of individuals, I was able to accept the idea of a force that moved in the rooms and animated AA members with a sense of unconditional love. That satisfied my spiritual needs for a long time. A later sponsor took me through steps 8 and 9. And provided me with support during trying times. In my third year of sobriety, I was bedridden for over a month as the result of that earlier injury to my spinal discs. My father died, a relationship ended, and the AIDS epidemic started to hit home among my friends and acquaintances. Over the course of that and the next few years, almost half of my gay friends died. I learned in that year that if I ask for help, my higher power will never give me anything I can't handle. So he's making reference here that he's in his third year of sobriety. Year of sobriety is 88. We're now in 91. He then references coming to more serious fatalities within the AIDS epidemic. Now we're in 92, 93, 94. I did look up at a chart. Actually, the peak is 1995. So it makes perfect sense in chronological order here. It was in this group that I started to turn service beyond the group level. I had helped in founding the first gay AA group in my part of town and was elected general service representative after having served in other group offices. I knew nothing of general service at that time, and I decided to learn what it was all about so I could do a decent job and be able to pass it on to a successor as quickly as possible. After 2 years, I went on to do a number of other service jobs in AA. So I found this to be admirable, saw the need for a gay meeting in his area. We don't know where he lives, but he takes the bull by the horns. So he's doing that in that time frame, in these mid-90s, let's say. But it made me dig into that, like, when did gay meetings start to be recognized? What's the first one? All this stuff. And I'm going to give you a source for that at the end if you really wanted to dig into that topic. But I'll give you a couple little tidbits right here. The first gay AA group held outside of a home. That's a key ingredient. There were plenty beforehand that were held sort of privately, but created by gay members for gay members, and to be publicized as a gay meeting, gay AA meeting, is in 1968 in San Francisco. It was called the Friday Night Fell Street Group, F-E-L-L. And so again, that's in 1968. And the other little tidbit that I thought was interesting, the first gay listing in the AA World Directory was in 1975. But as soon as the that 1968 meeting happened in San Francisco, they started to come up also in L.A., Washington, New York. So snowball effect from that. This was the thing that I really loved, warmed my heart. Story in 1949, a member, Ed S. from Boston, comes to Bill and says, Bill, I want to start a meeting. And in 1949, they used the term homosexual. I want to start a meeting for homosexuals. And this is Bill's response. Quote, whatever you do to discuss your problems and to stay sober, if you will go to any lengths to achieve sobriety, please do so. I just thought that that was such the perfect answer. And you know, when you put it in the light of 1949, Bill continues to inspire. Okay. In all these positions, I never felt obligated to conceal or deny my sexuality. I have always felt that the representatives of groups in my area were concerned only with how we carried the message of recovery, not with what I might do in my personal life. When I first came to this fellowship, I had lost my health and sanity, my friends, much of my family, my self-respect, and my God. In the years since, all of these have been restored to me. I no longer have the sense of impending doom. I no longer wish for death or stare at myself in the mirror with loathing. I have come to terms with my higher power. After more than a dozen years in the AA fellowship, I was able to join a religious group and have now become active in that organization. I have a full, happy life with friends and loving family. Recently, I retired and have begun to travel throughout the world. I have attended and I have attended and felt welcome at AA meetings wherever I have gone, inside and outside the United States. Even more important, I have returned to my home group and am still asked to make coffee. I now have an extended family that is international in scope, all the members of which are joined by bonds of shared pain and joy. That was really powerful for me. And so that means the story would have been written like in 2000 or right as this fourth edition came out, which is in 2001. And that's how we were able to backload a lot of those years. But for someone that's really interested in this topic and wants to dig a little bit deeper, I did find out that the definitive book out there right now on this is The History of Gay People in AA. And it's written by Audrey Borden, B-O-R-D-E-N. And with that, I'll shut up. Thanks.